Okay. Hour has arrived. We'll call the meeting of the House Labor Committee to order. There is a quorum present, and members, you're going to find a copy of the minutes of the February 20th, 2019 minutes in your folder. Are there any additions or corrections? Representative Purcell, would you like to move the minutes of the February 20th, 2019?
I'd be happy to move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any discussion on that? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, we've got the minutes approved. First on the agenda is House File 947, and I will move that House File 947 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. We have the bill before us. Representative Mahoney, Chair Mahoney. We also have an A1 amendment. Any discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I have a little technical piece to that amendment. I do not. It's incorporated into here as far as I can tell. Having just come out of the committee.
Chair Mahoney, are you contemplating an oral amendment?
I am contemplating an oral amendment, Mr. Chair, but I am not finding it in my file.
Chair Mahoney, I think Mr. Weeks can help us with that.
That'd be great.
Mr. Chair, members, the Department of Labor and Industry just had a small correction to the A1 amendment, and that would be on page 1, line 20, delete a person and insert an individual.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. That is the amendment. The amendment to the amendment.
That's the amendment to the amendment. Discussion on that proposal. And the amendment to the amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Into the amendment then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to add that to the bill and get the bill in the shape that I would like it in. Would you like me to explain the amendment?
I'll move the amendment.
Thank you.
Go ahead and explain, please.
The amendment is a more of a technical piece from the department. I can call up the department to explain the amendment if you would like, Mr. Chair.
That would be fine. Thank you, Chair Mahoney. Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Kate Pruszek. I'm the Director of Legislative Affairs at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. The A1 amendment, as Representative Mahoney said, is a result of technical assistance provided by the department. The amendment deletes the definition of employer and instead adds reference to an existing statutory definition in Chapter 181.171. This is just a reference change. The bill continues to apply to employers with one or more employees in Minnesota and includes the state and political subdivisions of the state. It deletes the definition of wages and instead lists the form of remuneration in Section 3, which includes wages, salary, earnings, or commissions. And then it deletes vague language prohibiting requiring wage history to meet certain criteria, and it inserts language to better get at the intent of the subdivision, which is prohibiting employers from using wage history information received to determine future wages, salary, earnings, or commissions. Another change makes the civil penalty payable to the employee or prospective employee instead of to the department, and finally clarifies that affected persons are eligible for compensatory damages for lost wages in addition to relief awarded by a court.
And Mr. Chair.
Chair Mahoney.
Because this bill is not in the governor's budget, this was just technical help from the department, rather to get the bill in language that is better. They are not supporting or opposing the bill. Although I think they should support the bill. But so, Mr. Chair, the reason for 947. Thank you.
We need to have discussion on the amendment. Is there any discussion on the amendment as amended? Okay. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious to know what is Section 181.171.
I'm sorry, I did not hear you.
I said on page two of the amendment, 2.2, what is section 181.171?
Chair Mahoney.
Page two?
2.2 of the amendment.
That is the wage and hour laws section of the statutes.
Chair Mahoney.
181? Yeah, that's the wage and hour sections of the state statutes.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then to that, this would, you'd have to go to court?
For the courts?
You said it's by a court. The relief is granted by the court.
Well, Chair Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What that does is the court clarifies the affected person as are eligible for compensation for lost wages in addition to relief from a court. So it would be in addition to whatever a court does or does not decide. So if there's a civil penalty, and it, rather than give it to the department and the general fund, it goes to the offended party.
We'll talk more after the amendment is adopted, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further discussion on the amendment? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Relative to the original bill with on 2.3, it said require that a prospective employee's prior wage. That would, to me, indicate that if they could voluntarily disclose it. I'm wondering how the new amendment affects that, because now under 1.12, it says use any wage history information. So I would have read from 2.3 on the old one that if they voluntarily gave me that information, that I could use it. Now I'd be concerned under 1.12 that if they told me that, how would I divorce it from what I've been told in making a decision?
So,
Chair Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is your actual question?
Mr. Chair.
No, I just can't hear, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Vogel.
So the question is that under 2.3 before, it said the employer could not require that a prospective employee's prior wage or salary meet certain criteria. Correct. Now, under 1.12, it says the employer can't use any wage history information. My concern is that it did, to me, indicate under 2.3 the old way that if they could voluntarily tell you that if they wished. Under 1.12, I'd be concerned if they voluntarily told me that. Now I know something that I can't use, but how can I divorce what I already now know from my mind in making a decision or be able to prove that?
Chair Mahoney.
Two things here. I can't, neither can the employer, control what someone voluntarily tells you. And I, not being a lawyer, I don't know how a plaintiff, how someone could use that against you in court to say that you use what I told you freely against me. And
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's why I was asking for clarification, because when I say, see, use any wage history information, I now have wage history information. Would that preclude me then from even talking to that person as a protected employee? That's the problem that I have with the use any, because now I have information that I can't use, and therefore I could be accused later of using that information even though it was voluntarily given to me. And I know it's a technicality, but I look at this stuff from an employer standpoint, and I know that I'm on the hook if some lawyer decides to come after me.
Is there a question in there?
So the question is, yes, is, you know, how is that addressed? Is that the intent here, that the employer could not use any information, because if the information was voluntarily given, you would be using it because now you know it? So is that the intent of the legislation, or should the wording be changed so that it's more clear, so that an employer couldn't be held liable for something that they didn't intend to do?
Chair Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, technically they could.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any more discussion on the amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the bill's in the shape that the author prefers. Have at her.
Mr. Chair, the basis, there is one testifier here. The basis for this amendment is that women get paid 83 cents on the dollar that a man does. And if you go to African-American or a Latino or any person of color, it gets worse. Gets down to almost 40 cents on the dollar. There's no reason, and this is one of the reasons that that happens. Because you can say, oh, Miss whomever, how much did you make? And it perpetuates the fact that they are underpaid for the work that they do. And I don't think any of us want to see women get paid less than what they're worth. So that's how this—that's how this bill is. That's it.
You testify for the bill. If you'd identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, gentlemen of the committee. My name is Erin May Quaid. I am the advocacy director at Gender Justice, which is a legal nonprofit dedicated to achieving gender equity through the law. I appreciate the opportunity to testify here because this is a very it's a good bill that addresses a very urgent need we have here in Minnesota to close the gender and racial wage gaps. Women in Minnesota overall make about 83 cents to the dollar for every dollar that a man makes. And while this statistic alone is disturbing, it should shock us to know that Native women make 59.4 cents, Black women make 59 cents, Latinas make 53.3 cents. In other words, women of color in our state are earning slightly more than half of what white men earn. Women are being paid less on average than men because of outright discrimination and because subconscious biases and stereotypes often lead employers to perceive women negatively in negotiations and evaluations. This is particularly true for women and people of color who face not only gender but racial discrimination in our workplaces. When employees rely on applicants' prior salary in setting pay, pay inequities are perpetuated throughout the applicant's careers. If any prior employer in her work history paid her less than she would have been making than a white man, steered her toward a lower-paying support position within a company when she was qualified to do other jobs, or she worked in previously worked in a female-dominated profession where pay is disproportionately lower than positions requiring equal skill and effort that have been traditionally held by men, and caretaking is a really good example here. And the hiring employer asks what she was paid in her last job to set the amount they will offer her, the prior pay discrimination will always follow her, depressing her wages. Under the Equal Pay Act, a factor other than sex allows employers to pay people differently. It has to be legitimately related to jobs. But yesterday, the Ninth Circuit issued an opinion stating that that salary histories are, in fact, a sex-related factor. And using prior history of salary allows employers, I'm quoting here, to capitalize on the persistence of the wage gap and perpetuate that gap ad infinitum. Further, they note that, and I quote here, at the time of the passage of the Equal Pay Act, an employee's prior pay would have reflected a discriminatory marketplace that values the equal work of one sex over another. Congress simply could not have intended to allow employers to rely on these discriminatory wages as a justification for continuing to perpetuate wage differentials. These wage differentials still exist in our job marketplace today. I'm being short for you. Brevity is nice. House File 947 would encourage employers to de-bias their hiring process. If the applicant's prior salary isn't the basis for determining the compensation they offer an applicant, they will find job-related and market comparisons to determine what salary range that job function is worth to the company, not how a previous employer evaluated an applicant's value at a different company. A recent field experiment conducted by Georgetown and NYU Stern School of Business in 2017 found that a treatment group of employers who could not observe the compensation history of job applicants and a control group that could, in the treated employers group that could not ask about the salary history, they relied more heavily on alternative signals of productivity, they evaluated more applicants, and evaluated those applicants more intensively. They also responded by changing what kind of workers they evaluated. The treated employees group evaluated workers with about 7% lower past average wages and hired workers with about 16% lower past average wages. Last and perhaps most importantly, this policy has been shown and proven to reduce the wage gap between men and women. An October 2018 report found that in the 8 states that have these past salary bans, women earnings ticked up about 4 cents more on the dollar compared to men when they're compared to women in other states. So although reliance on prior salary is common, it's rapidly becoming less so as research indicates its depressing effect on the wages of women and people of color by perpetuating discrimination. There are many companies, large companies, that have stopped using this question altogether. It is not a necessary business practice. To determine an applicant's value, employers can look to experience, skills, and the responsibilities of an applicant that they will be assuming, and more accurate indicators that are less likely to be affected by discrimination than previous pay. It should be the public policy of this state to encourage hiring systems in the private sector that do not perpetuate wage inequalities, and this bill is one step that the legislature can take to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. To the author.
I said my piece earlier. This is a bill that helps women earn what they are worth.
Discussion on the bill.
Or gets it closer.
Thank you. Discussion on the bill. Any Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair, I have a concern that it could actually work to harm a person from the standpoint that if indeed they have done a good job and they are well above where you might think that they're going to be paid at this point in life, that they can't come in and use it as a negotiating tactic to get a higher wage than what was actually thought to be paid. And the example I would use is that you could have somebody with 15, 20 years experience that could come in and say they were getting $60,000 for this job. Somebody else comes in and they've been working 7 years and they're making $85,000 for the same job. I would look at that as if I was employing for that job, I'd like that employer to know that I'm making $85,000 because it separates me from that crowd and says, you know what, my past performance has driven a higher pay rate. It gives me a better chance of getting a higher salary and getting the job. Is there any way in this bill that somebody could volunteer that information and use it to their advantage when they have done well in life and been productive?
To the author.
Mr. Chair, we can dream up scenario after scenario after scenario. And most of the time, I did not ever hear anything such as that. But as I said, we can dream up a scenario. This bill comes to the Jobs Committee. You certainly can come and talk to me. We'll talk with the advocates. We'll talk with the department, see if there's better clarifying language. But again, I can dream up a scenario as well as the next guy, and I have. I don't see that scenario happening.
Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I can actually attest that the scenario can happen because I've had it happen to me. And it put me in a position to actually offer the person more money because I knew what they were making, where they were. I was going to have to attract them with at least more money, and it would have worked to their disadvantage had they not been able to tell me that. It would have worked to my disadvantage as well because I actually did end up hiring them, and I would have not had as good of employee as I had because I didn't know. But because I had some way of referencing what they had been performing at because the previous employer got them there, it gave them and me an advantage and made the company better off. So it isn't just a scenario of a might. I've actually experienced it myself, Mr. Chair.
Well, Chair Mahoney, would you like to respond?
Yes, Mr. Chair. You have one example. I can bring out 1,000 examples of women that have been paid less than men, less than what they're worth, because they did tell. I'll work for the thousands, you can work for the one.
Any other comments on the bill? Anybody in the pub from, oh, excuse me, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, as an employer, could you ask the question, how much do you think you should be paid?
Representative Mahoney.
I don't believe that this bill would prevent that.
Okay. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I spent 35 years as a school teacher. My salary was public information. And you're considering hiring me, and you've seen my salary someplace. Have you sought my salary then under your bill?
Chair Mahoney.
What, in your bill?
The word that you're using is seek. You shall not seek. Okay.
Chair Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I suppose that could be a problem. I don't think it is in a court because typically that will be in the newspaper. some point, your local newspaper is going to talk about teachers' salaries. The local news is going to talk about teachers' salary. So I don't think you would even have to ask. It would be public knowledge. And how could a court use public knowledge against you?
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it depends upon who your lawyer is, I guess.
Chair Mahoney.
You know, you got to love those lawyers, but you don't have to love them much.
Any other input on the bill from the committee? Anyone in the public would like to comment, share ideas on the bill? Okay. Seeing none, what's our motion? The motion is send this bill on its way to Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, it's on its way. Next up, we have Representative Mahoney with House File 878.
What was the number, 817 or 878?
878. Proceed with the bill.
Mr. Chair, would you move the bill to...
I'll move House File 878 for to send it on to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is an amendment in the file, or there should be.
I'll move the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I have a small... this has been one of my more fun bills. I've had more people than I care to think of come talk to me about it. And it's been a bill that we've heard one way or the other for the last 6 or 8 years. I'm trying to move them forward, both sides, and they have made some progress. And the amendment, the one they have not made a progress on, is on line 1.6, and it reads, page 1, delete line 20 to 22. I'd like to delete that line, Mr. Chair, in a verbal amendment. And what that is on the bill is... its retainage must be released within 30 days of the completed improvement date. It's the date that the advocates want to have everything paid by, and they're still working on that particular piece. And I intend to be more involved in the negotiations as we move forward, but that's a piece that no one can agree on just yet.
Okay, that would be, is this an amendment, amendment to the amendment? Go ahead, Mr. Weeks, please.
Sure, the amendment to the HO 878A1 amendment would just be page 1, delete line 6.
Correct.
And that would keep lines 20 to 22 in the bill.
Okay. Yes.
Everybody understand the amendment to the amendment? Okay. All in favor of the amendment to the amendment? So signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
This line's.
Okay, that moves forward to the amendment then.
Well, Mr. Chair, the amendment deletes a number of particular pieces and represents an agreement by the League of Cities and a number of other issues, other opponents, and the proponents of the bill. And I can certainly bring them up, League of Cities up, to explain their amendment, but it's kind of their agreement just yet. And then I call them up and they can have a little conversation about it.
Well, they're coming up. We have a question from Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to recall what rules you have with regards to amendments and so forth. If I remember correctly, this amendment, two of the amendment, would be out of order according to your rules.
Which rule are you referring to?
I don't have them in front of me, Mr. Chair, but...
The 24-hour rule.
The 24-hour rule, excuse me. I mean, it's... Okay.
The history of this committee and several others, we always incorporated the author's amendments to the bills. So there's past practice.
Mr. Chair, this changes the whole substance of the bill from my perspective. With all due respect, I mean, I was talking to some of the, I think Representative Mahorny referred to them, the advocates of this bill when he was doing his presentation, and I was told that this has been removed, the 30 days, and they're going to work on it moving forward. And quite frankly, Mr. Chair, I think this really substantially changes the bill. I've got information from county engineers in Northwest Minnesota, and this is probably the one of the largest sticking points in it.
You may be on that, you may be very well correct that it does change the bill substantially, but I'm going to follow through on past practice as far as allowing an amendment to the amendment from the author.
And Mr. Chair, if I might
Chair Mahoney.
Meeting prior to the committee, I informed the opponents to this particular bill, the advocates of the amendment, that we were going to take the 30 days out and we were going to continue to work on the bill. If the whole amendment has to go away to meet your rules, that's fine. We can do it in the next committee, but I would prefer to do this now so that no advocate or opponent to the bill can come back and say, oh, well, I want to change that. I would have the ability to say to the opponents, you agreed to this. We're not talking about that. We have to talk to the particular that are still left out. These are, there's quite a bit that has been taken out of the bill to satisfy the opposition, but we can continue to talk about all of that. It'll just puts all the agencies in a tizzy again.
Thank you, Chair Mahoney. You know, I'm getting the sense that there's some negotiations that are going to go on between this committee and the next. Am I correct in that?
Unfortunately, yes.
Okay, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just one quick point. Chair Mahoney, I've seen you work for a long time, and I don't know that I've ever seen you being concerned about an agency being in a tizzy.
You are absolutely correct, but I'm trying to be nicer in my old age.
Okay. Thank you. We have a testifier on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Irene Gowan with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I believe the question was specifically to this amendment. Is that correct?
Please proceed.
So the amendment is something that we did share with Chair Mahoney in terms of just the things that are still remaining, largely are clarifications. Some of the language in the original bill is written in a way where you're not sure who has ownership for what. So some of it, in terms of most of it, actually, that is the case. There is substantively one other thing that is left in there, a deletion on page 2, lines 1 through 4. But everything else mostly is a clarification to make sure that we know either is it a public owner or is it the primary general contractor who's responsible for these actions, which you're going to hear more about in testimony soon to come.
Thank you. Any other concerns on the A1 amendment? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Now we have a bill in front of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Now I have, I think you have a list of testifiers, if I'm not mistaken.
I have first up, Wayne Waslowski from the Department of Administration. We're going to try to get through the full agenda here, so if we could stick around, stick it to 2.5-3 minutes each, that would be very convenient.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Wayne Waslowski. I'm the Director of Real Estate and Construction Services for the Department of Administration. I appreciate the work of the chair and author and both the advocates and supporters. As been mentioned, there's a lot of conversations going on. But from the department's perspective, obviously, this has broad implications for us to be able to make sure that contract obligations are being met on our construction projects. First of all, would certainly like to acknowledge very much value our prime contractors and subcontractors that work on our project. We can't take care of state facilities without them. Prompt payment is something that is important throughout the life of a project. It's especially important for small businesses. as well as to meet diversity and inclusion goals. We track our performance on prompt payment, and we overall have a very good record on prompt payment. Retainage is an important tool at the on a project to make sure that important contract obligations are met, including punch lists that happen at the end of projects to get work fully completed, getting IC-134s, which is a statutory tax document that's required to be submitted before final payment is issued, as-built documents and owners' operations and maintenance manuals that explain to us how we're supposed to operate equipment. It's important from a facility management standpoint. Our record on retainage is, as a public owner, we pay out retainage when contract obligations are met, and we make sure we're doing that. We also understand on the other side of the issue, if you have a longer life project, that some of those first subcontractors on jobs are waiting a long time for their retainage. So we look forward to working with the author and all the parties to hopefully come up with language that satisfies all the interests. With that, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would stand for any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for that particular testifier? Hearing none, up next is Chris Bird, Benton County Engineer, followed by Laura Ziegler.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chris Bird, and I'm the County Engineer for Benton County. But I'm speaking here on behalf of the Minnesota County Engineers Association that is comprised of members from all 87 counties. I'm here to testify in opposition to House File 878 in the manner it was originally written. As originally written, it would have a negative effect on local units of government and the way we administer publicly funded road and bridge projects. As introduced, 878 would force counties and cities to release contract retainage before contractors had fulfilled all contractual obligations. The language in the bill that refers to completion improvement date is problematic for road and bridge projects. The nature in which these projects are constructed is such that they are often open to users, in other words, open to traffic, while construction work is still progressing. During the life of a road and bridge project, there may be multiple completion dates as to when certain phases or a portion of that improvement is to be completed. In addition to the physical work, there is often necessary paperwork yet to be received prior to these completion dates. As previously mentioned, one of the most common pieces of paperwork is that IC-134 that we need to receive. This form certifies that contractors and subcontractors have fulfilled the requirements of Minnesota withholding tax laws. Current law prohibits local units of government from making that final payment until the Department of Revenue has received all IC-134s from all contractors that have performed work on that road or bridge project. Another common piece of critical paperwork that is sometimes hard to receive is the Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Payment Affidavit. Now, this affidavit is required if it has any federal money on the project, and there was a DBE goal. This is, for whatever reason, sometimes this form is delayed by the prime getting to the local unit of government. In my county alone, we have two outstanding contracts where we have not received these forms and are unable to get all the IC-134s from the prime contractor from their subcontractors. Next week, one of the projects, it'll be 1 year from the completion of work, and we have not received all the necessary paperwork, and therefore we're still withholding a small amount of retainage. Other times, paperwork may include material certifications, verifying the materials incorporated into the project met all testing requirements or applicable specifications. But I am happy to say that we do some more support the amendment that was offered up today. We are opposed to language in the bill that requires the retainage to be held in interest-bearing accounts. This is very problematic for local governments. For example, if the project uses state or federal money, as most road projects in my county do, the local agency does not receive the last 5% of that state funding or the last 10% of that federal funding until all paperwork is completed and project documentation has been audited. This means us local governments are fronting the final progress payments to the contractor with local funds from other governmental accounts.
Thank you, Mr. Bird. Can you finish up your thoughts?
Yes. So in summary, contractors are required to provide certain certification and documentation as part of their contractual obligations. We at the counties believe that retainage is being retained on the whole contract, not just the physical construction work. And we do not believe that all retainage should be released just when the physical work is completed.
Thank you. Laura, any questions of that testifier? Okay, Representative Fabian, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to the amendment, with the amendment as amended, scratching, deleting lines 20 and 22, what's your position on the amendment now? I've talked to my county engineers up there. I've got a string of emails about the problems raised by just the 30 days.
Mr. Byrd.
Yes, I would say the 30 days is still a concern for us. To put it in perspective, we're usually issuing monthly progress payments. So it's 30 days in between us inspecting and certifying the work that's been completed and paying that. It is still difficult to get a lot of that paperwork, certifications, whatever, within that 30 days. So that is still a concern for us county engineers.
Thank you. Any other concerns? Okay, and up next is Laura Ziegler. Thank you, Mr. Byrd. Laura Ziegler, please identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Laura Ziegler. I'm with Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. AGC is a statewide organization representing over 300 members. Our companies build our roads, bridges, transit systems as well. We have building contractors that do commercial construction as well. We are not in the single family residential arena. Roughly 80% of our contractors are union signatories. And because of how the nature of the construction industry works, we represent both subs and general contractors. Sometimes general contractors are subs in some projects. And I just want to clarify for those who might be new to this conversation as well, when we're talking about generals or prime contractors, we're talking about that contractor that is bidding on the project. So they are putting together that bid with all the subs to then submit that bid to the owner for the project. So retainage is an issue that affects every contractor all the way down the line. And subcontractors, of course, are going to differ in size. Their economies of scale, and depending on their capital and specialty, it's going to depend when they're entering the project to complete their scope of work. We do have a couple of concerns about the bill, and I'll try to keep it, address my comments to the amendment today. There was retainage legislation passed in 2016 that addressed contractors' concerns by reducing the maximum allowable amount for retainage. It was cut in half. It went from 10 to 5%. And that 10% was especially burdensome to contractors, especially subs, that finished their work earlier in the project but had to wait for the release of the retainage until the entire project was finished. So that overall was very helpful back in 2016. And we want to focus the conversation now on what's already been identified in that when the scope of work is completed, those lines 20 to 22 that we were talking about, that bar has been set at 30 days, that's where we'd like to focus the conversation. Because retainage is a flow-down provision between the owner and the prime, we are the go-between as general contractors between the owner and the subcontractors. Once a prime contractor receives either a progress payment or retainage, we are required by law to release that payment within 10 days. There's a Prompt Payment Act that was already mentioned by the previous testifier. In short, the generals just don't want to be the bank. If generals haven't received the money yet from the owner, they don't want to have to come up with that those remaining funds to then pay the subs. So we will work very closely with our partners in the ownership arena, as well as our subs, as we continue this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Ziegler. Any questions to the testifier? Hearing none, we'll move on to Irene Kale from the League of Minnesota Cities, and next would be Mark Maloney.
Mr.
Mr. Chair, members, we decided to come up together to save you some time. Again, my name is Irene Gao. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. For those of you who aren't familiar with the League is a membership organization for cities. 833 of the 853 cities are members, and we provide a number of services, including education, risk management, and advocacy. Today, so first I want to thank Chair Mahoney for working on this. I know it's probably more work than he thought it was going to be, and I appreciate his continued commitment on working on this. And thank you to the committee for adopting the amendment. It does address some of the League's concerns. Ms. Ziegler had already provided a bigger picture of how this works. I wanted to provide a bit of a picture on the public owner end. When we have city projects as public owners, we're the ones who contract with a prime or general contractor, who then works with subcontractors to get certain work done, such as excavation, electrical, landscaping, etc. Retainage is held, as we said, to ensure that the work is complete. Often it's things like punch list items, and for those of you who aren't familiar with punch list items, I went to Wikipedia to look up and see what they would say, and it said that punch list items is a document prepared near the end of a construction project listing work not conforming to contract specifications that the general contractor must complete before final payment. So often we find little things that still needs to be done, and from our end, we just want to make sure that the work is done, as well as required paperwork, which previous testifiers had talked about in terms of IC 134 forms, as-builts, owner's manuals, all things that are very important before we take on the project. As amended, we do appreciate those changes, and as previous testifiers have talked about, the release at 30 days of the last day of either the subcontractor's work or an item of skill, material, or machinery is provided, whichever is first could be problematic. But as Chair Mahoney has mentioned, this is the provision that we'll continue to work on. So at this point, we look forward to continuing to work with stakeholders and creatively thinking about how we can address the situation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Kyle. Any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, Mark Maloney, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mark Maloney. I'm the Public Works Director for the City of Shoreview, Minnesota. I've been in that capacity for 25 years, and for more than 34 years have been in some way managing public infrastructure contracts. And so I've spent in my entire career representing public interests in the infrastructure world. I wanted to point out to the committee that there is no advantage to a city or a county or a governmental agency in arbitrarily holding on to retainage. By the time we get to a construction project, those funds have been encumbered and identified specifically for that purpose, and the faster it's off our books, the better for us. We are subject to audit for our project management, and so there are strict compliance guidelines that have to do with how we manage the money. And you've heard references by earlier speakers regarding IC 134 forms, DBE forms, and so we take that very seriously. But I wanted to just reinforce the point that we have a common goal with contractors and subs to get these projects completed and finalized as fast as possible. As pointed out, our contracts have a standard of a 5% retainage built into them. It is the practice of my employer to actually reduce that percentage as the project goes on. We have no interest in arbitrarily holding large sums of money that aren't necessary to ensure the completion and compliance of the work. Over the course of my career, I have been involved with projects where it's been very difficult to get that final punch list finished. And it's particularly troublesome in my arena because the sort of work that is hanging out there that isn't done and it's holding up the process is exactly the sort of work that the public notices the most. It's the restoration work, it's the sodding work, it's the fixing of the driveways, it's the mailboxes being put back. It's the stuff that really touches people and impacts their quality of life. And so that's that part of the project, that end part of the project, is under a magnifying glass as far as the public is concerned. And so that 5% retainage or whatever lesser amount we feel is necessary to ensure compliance is a very important tool for us in the eyes of the public. I would just want to close in that we have sympathy for subcontractors who are having difficulty with their business relationships with their general contractors. We get the phone calls at City Hall from subcontractors who are saying, Was that project finaled? I'm still waiting for my payment from so-and-so. And we look at our checklist, and if they've complied, if the general contractor's complied with all the things that have been spoken to here, the IC-134 forms, DBE forms, construction manuals, as-builts, all that, all those terms of the contract, if they've been complied with, we've released the retainage. So we do understand there is some friction out there between subs and generals, but we see our role in government as being stewards of the public dollar, and we feel like some aspects of this bill and proposed legislation would drag us more into the private sector.
Thank you, Mr. Maloney. Any questions to the testifier? Any concerns with the testifier? Okay, hearing none, we have up next Donna Golden, followed by Mark Jaster and Jason Tarasek. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Donna Golden. I'm here to ask that you pass House File 878. For the past 23 years, I've been a woman business owner of a small construction company, second generation taken over from my parents. I have 36 employees. My company worked on a public project in the Twin Cities where my retainage from July, an invoice from July 2013, was not paid until May 2018. That's over 1,700 days from my first invoice. All my paperwork was in, and I had no punch line items left to complete. They told me there was an issue with an alarm system, and that was holding up my retainage, which had nothing to do with the work that we completed. After waiting that long, my profit margin on the job was completely gone, and each day I paid interest on my line of credit, and I paid my bookkeeper to keep making the calls to find out when we were going to get paid. Let me be clear. I would never expect to get paid if I hadn't completed all my obligations on the job. As you can imagine, this affected my ability to secure a line of credit from my bank because they do not take into account any receivables over 90 days when making a decision. This slow payment practice holds back my small woman-owned business from growing and creating jobs. It's been said that I should change the language in the contract during negotiations, but I don't negotiate the contract with the public owner. The GC does. What I do is perform the work, pay for the materials, labor, and insurance, and then act like the bank until they decide to pay me for my work. The current retainage practices need to be changed in Minnesota so small businesses can grow. Thank you, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Donna Golden. Any questions to that testifier? Okay, moving on to Mark Jaster. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mark Jaster. My wife and I own and operate Century Construction Company. We are a small commercial subcontractor that primarily performs interior demolition and finished carpentry work. Today, I'm asking you to pass House File 878. It is an important bill for subcontracting businesses and subcontracting families across Minnesota. Every day, like many subs, we have a significant amount of money being withheld as retainage for work that we have already completed. This has a very stressful impact on our business in particular. As a demolition contractor, we are typically the first subcontractor to go to work on a job, and almost always the first subcontractor to finish our portion of the job. But we must wait until the entire job is complete, sometimes a year or longer, until our retainage is released to us. For example, on one project, we have over $135,000 being held as retainage, and we have been waiting for over 7 months for it to be paid. Our portion of the project has been completed for that long. We have fully paid our employees and our suppliers for their work on the project, but we continue to wait to be fully paid for our work, and we have never had any of our retainage released early. This is a very serious problem when it comes to cash flow for our business. This bill is about basic fairness, helping small businesses, and promptly paying people for the work that they complete. I ask you to support this bill today, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Jaster. Any questions for Mr. Jaster? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Jaster. I appreciate the business that you do and the jobs you provide. Can you give us a little more detail about what explanations you're getting for not being paid for the work that you've completed from the general contractor?
It generally comes down to the, you know, our portion of the work happens early in the job. There's no dispute that our retainage is owed to us. Everyone agrees that our work has been completed, but because retainage won't be released until the entire project is completed, we wait for many months to see that money come back to us.
Any other questions for Mr. Jaster? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then, to both testify, well, not to the testifier, but to the chair, I'm not clear how your bill is going to solve his problem.
Mr. Jaster?
No, I think he's asking the chair. Well, that's what the 30 days is right there. And that's going to be problematic in the negotiations. This clarifies for the small contractors who they have to call at the general's office, because quite often they're not sure who the who their contract was with, because there's so many different contractors on a job site. There's a number of other things in here that help them at least get through to the person that they have to talk to. And then again, it's how long are they going to be able to withhold that the retainage?
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To be clear, I have great empathy for what you're going through. I have some really good friends back in my hometown who do a lot of the same kind of work that you do, maybe similar work anyway. And I want to make sure that we're addressing the issues that are going to solve your problem. And I'm not 100% clear that we're going to do that. But as it goes through the process, I'm sure that Chair Mahoney will make sure that you get your money.
Hearing no question, do either one of you like to respond?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to respond to his comments?
Oh, just vote with your friends.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Jaster. Last up is Jason Tarasek. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, committee members, my name is Jason Tarasek. I'm an attorney with a construction law firm called Thompson Tarasek Leo Halloran, and I'm also on the board of directors of the Minnesota Subcontractor Association. And it's true, what you've the stories you've heard from people who work in this industry, subcontractors wait months and years to get paid in full for their work. That's because of this 5% retainage withholding. Retainage is withheld. It's allowed because we have a statute that says it can be withheld. But the problem is that the statute never says when the retainage must be paid. Typically, subcontractors only get paid their retainage after the general contractor's scope of work is complete. But the problem with that is that's often months or sometimes even years after that individual subcontractor's scope of work has been finished. That's a huge cash flow problem for small businesses. It often is their profit margin on a job. But House File 878 attempts to address this problem. In particular, it says if retainage is withheld, it's going to be the same for everyone. It also says retainage can't be withheld to ensure warranty work, because that's what warranties are for. Rather, retainage is there to ensure that the work itself is completed. But once the work is finished, the money should be paid. The bill also says, and I recognize this is up for debate, that the retainage must be paid within 30 days after the, quote, completed improvement date, end quote. That completed improvement date is the last day an item of skill, material, or machinery is provided, and it comes out of the mechanics lien statute. That's a term used in that statute, section 514.08. which is established law, and it also makes common sense. Subcontractors should know whether they're going to be paid their retainage before their lien rights run out. The statute, the bill would also amend the statute that says if you choose to withhold retainage, oh, I'm sorry, I think this aspect, the escrow account is eliminated?
Yeah.
Okay. I apologize. The bill would also require that the owner's contact information be shared with subcontractors, and if a subcontractor makes a written request about non-payment, it requires the owner to let the subcontractor know if payment has been made. The bill would also make sure these retainage provisions extend to public work, and it ensures that any disputed retainage is documented. We're happy to continue working with all parties interested in this bill, but we ask that you support the bill as amended today. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Tarasek. Any questions for Mr. Tarasek? I do. Okay. We heard from a previous testifier that I believe she had 36 employees, and she had mounting legal fees and credit problems, exhausting her credit at the bank. And I'm just wondering, for these subcontractors that don't have those deep pockets, I'm just wondering, what's the bankruptcy rate for subcontractors in the construction industry in Minnesota? If you've got a number, fine. If not, maybe at the next committee stop, we'll hear something like that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know the answer to that specific question, but I can tell you that the subcontractors are the ones out there actually performing the vast majority of the work. The general contractor oversees the work, and so the subcontractors are, it's typical that they'll only have a handful of employees, two or three or four at that. So, you know, this money might be chicken feed to a general contractor, but it's really important to a subcontractor that's relying on that to pay the bills.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Tarasek? That's it for testifiers. Anyone from the public wish to weigh in on this bill? If not, questions to the author. Hearing none. 878, the motion was, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I looked in my folder and I found my committee rules. Number five, it says all substantive amendments need to be to the CA 24 hours in advance. Number six says minor oral amendments will be allowed. Mr. Chair, I think that, and again, I want to work on the bill. I want to solve the problem. But I've heard Speaker Hortman talk about procedure and process. And from my perspective, I think we're setting a bad precedent today by taking the oral amendment. And again, I repeat, I want to help solve the problem, but I think we're going about it in the wrong way. We've talked a lot about the public and transparency and making sure that people know the bill as it was, amendment as it was posted with the 24-hour rule, gave people a pretty substantial idea of what was going to be brought to the committee today. And I'm going to vote for the bill, but I'm opposed to the process.
So noted.
Final comments, Mr. Chair? This seems like a small problem for most people when you stop and think 5%. But take it in the context that there's almost $10 billion worth of construction in the state of Minnesota. And they should have done the math before, but that's a lot of money. And most of these are small and mid-sized contractors. Is the bill perfect right now? No. Will it be when it's passed? I doubt it. But we need to get closer to a place where we can help these small businesses stay in business, whether they're whatever they're doing, whatever kind of construction they're doing. So I can be abrupt, and I apologize for that. But I hope you'll trust that I will continue to work and draw both sides together to try to find some compromise. This is just not fair to these small contractors having to wait a year, sometimes more, to make sure the grass is grown. And somebody put it down in the fall, and they didn't get paid because they couldn't be assured that that grass was going to grow in September and in the spring. So I will continue to work on this. I give you my word, and I will, if I have to get one of the larger committee rooms to get everybody that's got a horse in this race together, but I will, at the end of the day, come up with something or the bill won't move.
Thank you, Chair Mahoney. I'd like to renew my motion to refer this 878 to the House Ways and Means Committee as amended. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Representative Brand. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move my bill, please.
Okay, we have House File 726. Representative Brand, proceed.
So the bill's a pretty small bill, but what it does is it actually puts together a group of stakeholders across our state to address concerns with the affordability of housing in our state. You know, I had actually had a conference call recently with Senator Matt Little, who's actually the architect of this bill by himself. Nobody's pushing this bill, no outside or inside lobbyists or anything like that. He's a former mayor in Minnesota, and I'm a former city council member myself, and so I just remember back to those years of talking about housing and trying to build housing in St. Peter, where I'm from, and the cost associated with that, and trying to make things work. And I just know that we've had conversations with our building inspector, and we've had council confirmation, we've had conversations with a lot of different folks, and it keeps coming down to the contractors are saying the same thing that a lot of other people are saying, and that's that it's expensive to build in the state of Minnesota. But if you look at that last governor's report on housing, it was suggested by the year 2030, we're going to need to have 300,000 new homes in Minnesota built. And if the cost of the affordability of homes in the state are continuing to rise at a pace that's outmatching the ability for people to pay for those houses, there's got to be a greater conversation that has to occur across our state. And so what I'm here today is to propose this bill, which would create a more open discussion about the building code. I'm not advocating that we remove anything in particular. I'm not suggesting that we remove the whole entire thing for that matter. But what I'm saying is that we should include a group of stakeholders that didn't get a large enough say in the topic in the past. And so, you know, if you look, there's not a specific list of people. We wanted to initially draft this as pretty narrow and allow anybody who has an interest to be on this advisory group to be so. And any stakeholder can come on board. It was written narrowly for that purpose. We've had some conversations with a couple of other folks, the American Institute of Architects, the Association of Minnesota Building Officials, Minnesota Housing First. There's a couple of groups there in Minnesota that have had a conversation with me. IBEW has had a conversation with me via email. I keep coming back to the basics here. One in four Minnesotans, nearly 55,000 families in our state, are spending more than 30% of their income on housing. And that's an increase of 60% since 2000. So as I look at how we fix the solution or how we revise our building costs, our housing costs in Minnesota, credit obviously is part of it, budget's part of it, and then also the regulatory piece, I think, is a third piece that we have to look at. So I stand for any questions, and I know we've got some testifiers for and against.
Yeah, do you want to go right ahead with the testifiers? I have a list.
Certainly.
Right here. Scott McClellan, please. Department of Labor and Industry. Followed by Steve Noble, Kurt Welker.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Scott McClellan. I'm an assistant commissioner for the Department of Labor and Industry and also the state building official. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. Although I'm here to speak against House File 726, the department sincerely appreciates the spirit of the bill, which we believe is to ensure that affected stakeholders have a role in deciding what regulations are contained in the codes, whether that means repealing existing requirements or adopting new ones. And as Representative said, I had met with Representative Brand last week to discuss the bill and to explain what the department has already been doing, what I believe achieves the author's intent without the need for additional legislation. So I'd just like to very briefly explain to you how the construction industry has just concluded a very extensive process of evaluating each of the codes adopted by our agency. The handout that's being circulated to you right now is a brief excerpt from a 66-page report by the Construction Codes Advisory Council on their recent review about a year ago of both newly proposed and existing codes. The council is required by statute to review all laws, codes, and rules relating to building construction, and then recommend ways to streamline, eliminate inconsistencies, and increase understanding. As you receive that handout, on pages 4 and 5, there's a list of the members of the advisory council that represents the construction industry. Pretty broad representation, so I'd just like to bring that to your attention. However, the council selects other uniquely qualified people in the construction industry to serve on the technical advisory groups, or TAGs, to study the codes in more detail. And beginning on page 6 of your handout, there are several pages there, but it lists 10 different technical advisory groups that were established by the council to determine what should be included in the new codes that we're slating for adoption in 2020. Each of these groups have met many times and spent countless hours over the past year studying, discussing the codes, what should be contained in the codes. And as you can see on these pages, the numerous stakeholders that are highlighted in yellow there, again, represent quite a few people in the construction industry that participated in this process. And some testaments to the success of this process are two letters we received, one during the actual review process that's contained in the back of your packet there, and the other one we just recently received from a contractor. And I'd encourage you to review the highlighted remarks there. My hope is that after listening to today's testimony and reviewing what I've shared, that you would conclude that the intent and spirit of the bill is being accomplished in an environment where all of the impacted stakeholders currently participate and have a voice in what gets repealed or added to our codes, therefore not requiring additional legislation to repeat that effort. That concludes my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. McClellan? Stick around. Oh, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McClellan, on the very first page where you have the yellow highlight, the Minnesota legislature requires the Commissioner of Department of Labor Agency to review. Do other states require that same review?
Mr. McClellan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, do other states require that similar review? Referring to other states? Many states are set up differently. Many of them have some sort of a board or council that weighs in on it, sometimes authoritatively. Our Construction Codes Advisory Council is just that. It's advisory in nature, and they advise the Commissioner of Labor and Industry as to what they recommend should be included in the rulemaking process.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then on pages 4 and 5, where you talk about the advisory council members, okay, where I look at addresses, and I recognize that associations represent entities from all around the state, I really don't see any representation except for organizations or associations that represent, I'll say, northern Minnesota. I hope that, Representative Brand, when you bring your bill forward, that you will look for, and I notice in your bill, you know, you kind of give some general outlines here, guidelines, but I hope that you will actually seek out statewide representation from both small and large builders.
Mr. Chair, can I respond?
Mr. Brand,
the intent is to just have it as an open call, and so far we've actually been getting both in my office and then in the Senate as well, we've been getting associations and different organizations who have expressed exclusive interest in this bill and also being participants.
Okay, thank you. Next testifier up would be Steve Noble.
Yep, I'm not Steve. Nope. And I'm not Kurt. Both of them supplement their income during the winters being, they remove snow for a living when they're not building houses. And so they're off using their skid loaders and the like. And I'm Remy Stone. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Builders Association of Minnesota, and I'm your fourth person on your list of testifiers.
Welcome.
Thank you. As I said, I represent the Builders Association of Minnesota. We're an organization, a statewide organization of roughly 1,800 builder members and associates who represent or employ 54,000 Minnesotans across the state. We were very intrigued with this piece of legislation because it, for one, we participated in the governor's task force on housing, and this is one of the recommendations that the governor's task force came up with, but also because we do participate in DLI's process to review the code, and we do value what they do. However, as Mr. McClellan said, what those functions do is we go through the codes and determine what should be included or amended in Minnesota's code, but we've never done a comprehensive exercise in what ought to be repealed. And so that's what we found interesting about this House file and also Senator Little's bill. I handed out to you a list that Steve was going to share. It's got the list of extras and expensive and nonsense code provisions. And I'll just let that speak for itself, but he did ask that I share that with you. I would point out that WOCD does not mean obsessive compulsive disorder. It simply means window operating control device. So when you read that, realize that that's coming from a contractor's perspective on cost. You know, today we could talk about really broad topics like the energy code or foundation bracing, but I just wanted to point out a couple of things that our members repeatedly mentioned to us that ought to be considered, maybe or maybe not for repeal, but ought to be looked at. And one of those things is this whole issue of window cleaning anchors. And we're talking about affordability in housing. The average cost on a four-story multi-housing structure, where we put a lot of our affordable housing, this issue has come forward by one of our affordable housing members, is roughly $60,000 just to engineer and anchor those all the way down into the foundation of a building. It has a huge impact on affordability, and in fact, one of the solutions, rather, it's been raised, and I know that these individuals have brought it forward in the code adoption process, but it's also a part of pending legislation in House File 1634 of Representative Tice's and also in Senate File 1456, which Senator Senjum has. But that's one of those items that gets pointed out to us as to if you want to deal with affordability, this is a big topic. The reason why that's a big topic is those anchors serve no purpose on those units because window washers use the baskets to hit four stories. So it's just the way it is. There's the issue of arc fault circuit interrupters, and I wanted to raise that to you because I'm sure all of you have enjoyed maybe some time plugging in your vacuum or seeing your refrigerators pop the circuits. And they may or may not be necessary to stay in the code, but I want to just point out a cost here. They roughly cost $620 per housing unit. Okay, may not seem like a lot, but considering we built last year 12,600 one and two family homes, that's just of the one and twos, that actually cost Minnesota home buyers $7,843,000. So that one provision cost Minnesotans that much. And then I also handed out, and I'll end on this, you all have a really interesting article from the Star Tribune, and that's called Dishwasher Air Gaps. So, and I'll start with this quote because it's sort of fun. One of the most conspicuous and annoying changes made to the new plumbing code is the hideous dishwasher air gaps. And I think maybe many of you have seen it. It's the little pop-up that's on your countertops now. It's a relatively low-cost item, about $150. But there's a strong case to question whether it's reliable and whether it performs well, because we know in the field that oftentimes when you have a backup, it comes up and out and spills all over the countertops. may or may not be of value, but we ought to consider whether that's necessary. Because I can assure you, when I redid my kitchen in 2014 before this code happened, we just tied our dishwasher into our disposal, and it took care of that airflow problem in and of itself. And if any of you are still doing the math, that one $150 item cost the one- and two-family home buyer last year $1,890,000. So while they may seem incremental in cost in aggregate, these are very expensive items that may or may not have to be repealed or ought to be repealed from the code. With that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Chair. To Remy, to your point on both of these wonderful issues you brought up, for those of you that do not know, the dishwasher air gap is a completely useless thing, and if you're drilling through granite, it's actually going to cost quite a bit more. Every new dishwasher has an air gap built on the side of it today. So it's a double redundancy. And then to your arc fault thing, it was unproven technology. It was shoved down our throats. And anything that has a motor in it tends to trip those breakers. And I personally have gone back to the same laundry room and replaced that guy's breaker about a dozen times until we told him to hire somebody else. I rest.
Thank you, Representative Mecklen. Any other questions for Ms. Stone? We have Kurt Welker. In the room?
I'm Kurt and Steve today.
Whoa.
They're off moving snow.
Thank you. How about Nick Erickson?
Hi, thank you. My name is Nick Erickson. I'm the Regulatory Affairs Manager for Housing First Minnesota. And I want to thank Representative Brand for bringing a housing affordability issue before this committee. There's been a lot of talk lately about housing affordability and how it's eroded. We recently did a study and found that up to one-third of the new home's price comes from regulations. We've also heard from Governor Dayton's Housing Task Force from last year that we have a critical need for housing in the state, 300,000 new units by 2030. And over the next 5 years, just to stabilize our housing market, we need 50,000 units above current production levels. All of that is for naught if we cannot build homes more affordably, and that's really what this piece of legislation does. I'd be remiss if I didn't note that Assistant Commissioner McClellan is probably the best example of a state agency focused on housing affordability. The 2 years that I've had a chance to work with Assistant Commissioner McClellan, we have seen nothing but affordability-centric decisions being made by the Department of Labor and Industry. I know the dishwasher air gap was just brought up. It's actually something that we petitioned the plumbing board to remove, and they're looking at removing now with the next plumbing code. And, if the other dozens of other housing regulators in the state took the approach that Mr. McClellan has taken over the last 2 years, we wouldn't really need to have all this different legislation. And, I think we say what other housing regulators, I think it's been a little confusing lately at the Capitol. We've seen the Department of Labor and Industry kind of be the only entity that's being brought up in discussion of housing regulations. But there's the Minnesota Department of Health and Natural Resources, PCA, Bowser. We also have the Met Council. We have cities, townships, and counties that all play a role in the housing affordability discussion. I think it's important as this body moves forward with any legislation that it is aware that this is not a single agency problem. It is a broader problem of housing affordability. And I do want to thank Representative Brand for bringing this issue forward today.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Erickson? Okay. Any input from the public? Anybody like to weigh in on this? Now is your chance. Seeing none, Representative Brand, your comments on the bill.
Yeah, I just wanted to state that, I have no axe to grind or I have no case to make on this. I don't have any particular burning desire to get rid of any one particular code, that sort of thing. I just bring my experience as a city council member in St. Peter and Greater Minnesota to the table, and I ask that we have a greater conversation about building code, because in Greater Minnesota, just like the rest of Minnesota, even in the Twin Cities here, housing is important, and housing is getting expensive. As I addressed before, 55,000 Minnesotans are spending more than 30% of their income on the housing, and that's an increase of 60% since 2000. And so as we talk about housing into the future, we'll have to talk about the credit, the budget, and, of course, the regulatory piece. And today this is what I'm hoping to at least start the conversation with.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Any further comments, questions for Representative Brand? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know this housing affordability has been a big issue. And coming out of the construction field myself, we look at some of this stuff, and I don't know if eliminating these codes and looking at them, and I don't think having this creating this board to look at, their stakeholder group to look at this, but it's a big complicated issue. My parents, when they bought their house back in the 50s, it was an affordable house. It was just the house with the well and a septic system. Now, some of the city, and we talk about city councils, and some of the cities, they require streets, they require sewer, they require a curb and gutter, all those things, and you get to the point where before you even start, you may be out of affordable range depending on where you're building the house. So this is a big issue we need to look at, and I think this is the committee going forward might be a good idea to do this and start this. So I support the bill, but I think there are going to be some prizes here. I don't think this list of things that we were given here, when you multiply multiple houses, it's a lot of money, but on an individual house, some of the safety items that we're talking about here might not be wise to eliminate them also.
I've got a couple of comments, and I use this term often, maybe too often, and I don't mean to insult anybody that serves on this technical advisory group, but, you know, because I know some of these people, and they're very smart, and some of them are, I'm just assuming, smart in school, but not that clever on the bus. What Representative Mecklen brought up, the concerns about real-life experience with some of these issues that could be addressed through the advisory council, I think maybe we should get somebody with some blisters on their hands to weigh in on with these advisory councils as well. Oh, Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what's the motion on this bill, Mr. Chair? Well,
the motion on this bill is actually to refer to GovOps.
Okay, good. So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you. So, Representative Brand, you've got kind of an outline here. What is your plan for this bill to amend it and make some changes to get it the way it actually could work better, maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. So the next step is to get that list of folks that we've been collecting and add them to that as an amendment and add that as a group that would be interested in participating as well. So, you know, we've got some builder associations, some labor groups, firefighters obviously have an interest in stake and other interested stakeholders too. And it's preparing something that we can put together, have the conversations over the summer and the fall, and then you know, they would report back to us here at the beginning of next year, and then next year in a year where we can have a conversation about more policy-oriented things, of course, with the bonding stuff too, then maybe we can address some of these issues here again.
Okay, Representative Brand, thank you for your bill. Any further comments? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm guessing that to put together a stakeholder group, there's going to be a fiscal impact at some point. Have you asked for some sort of a fiscal note?
Representative Brand.
No, I have not. You know, I take that back. I did actually send that in. So we're waiting for the report to come back.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Brand, would you be open to entertain the idea you have to review building code? Would you be willing to maybe add in there as end regulations?
Representative Brand.
Well, I think this is just an open discussion, and so I would think that they would want to have, I don't want to give the stakeholders too much direction without enough leeway. And so it might turn out that there would be a regulation or so that would be discussed about ending. And then that would be brought back in a report. Then we would actually have to make that move to do that. But, I mean, it would be good information for us to know exactly what the industry is thinking. Bottom line is I want to make sure that housing is not unsafe, but there are obviously things been pointed out where the cost of the house itself is perhaps unattainable for a lot of folks because it's out of reach with these little additional things here and there being added to the total price.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for the author? Thank you. I'm going to renew. Would you like to renew your motion to refer 726 to the GovOps.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. You're on your way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
We've only got 6 minutes to get to 879, so we'll push that back until next week. But we need to recall the minutes from February 20th. The minutes say we started at 3:31. We started at 2:31. So I'm going to make a motion to recall the minutes from 2:20 and make the changes to the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. We'll make the minutes are now in front of us. Let's make the change on the time starting to 2:31. Any questions? Any further questions on those minutes? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Okay, they're reapproved. We're adjourned.